I'm not 100%.
Okay, if you want to, we can go on. I've just mailed you a brief Excel with the energetics. Maybe
Fantastic.
We can reopen the discussion on this. I've also found something on electron spin, which we might want to throw in the magnet motors. So anytime.
All right. Well, the recording is going now.
Okay.
I can see you've got these calculations here. I've just got those up. So let's have a look if I can. 221 billion kilojoules missing.
Right. This is what Hoffman estimated for the destruction of the North Tower alone in the Kirk King paper you sent me. And I think this is relevant to our listeners because this is something that you asked me at the end of the last part yesterday, and it might be interesting. The towers were not vaporized. That's not true. They were reduced to dust, a sizable portion of them, of course, most of them reduced to dust, which is different from being vaporized.
Yeah.
So when they were reduced to dust, Kirk King calculates the energy and based on Hoffman, and it's about the energy of 5 kilotons. Now, the Hiroshima bomb, which is the smallest typical nuclear device detonated in the open, if I recall correctly, not in test or anything.
Mm.
That was 15 kilotons.
Right.
So it's pretty much within the reach of our military capability, regrettably.
Mm. Mm.
So, of course, this energy went off in 10 seconds. Now, I've looked up on the internet, and there is some controversy. Some people don't accept that the towers went down in 10 seconds. They think that the lower bound might be 13 seconds. But this does not change the argument so much. It might challenge Judy Wood's assertion that the towers fell without resistance, but it does not challenge the energetics. And the energetics will give you 5 kilotons for each tower in 10 seconds. That's 2 terawatts power, roughly. And the energy usage of the Earth, I just looked it up in the statistics for 2001, it was about 12 terawatts. So, even for both towers, we would have about 4 terawatts. So we are well within the energy usage of the Earth, the power consumption of the Earth, and the capability of a tactical nuclear device. Certainly, I mean, I don't see, and I concur with Hoffman's and Kirk King's assertion that this is out of the reach of chemical explosives. You would need to place 5 tons worth of explosives in the building to allow this to happen. And I think that Kirk King also found out, of course, that the impact of the planes by themselves is woefully inadequate if there were planes at all. So, And as a last curiosity, I found out that, yes, certainly, if the towers were vaporized, then we would go out of the reach of the power consumption of the Earth because we would go into the hundreds of terawatts. But even then, the explosion would be in the order of megatons, which, you know, was out of reach for the military in Hiroshima in the time of Hiroshima, but it's certainly not out of the reach now. So, but that's not the case because they were not vaporized. So I thought this might be an amusing curiosity to some listeners.
Yes, I think it's all just interesting to me because this Greg Jenkins character, who has done research which was in part sponsored by the NSA, seems to have gone underground since the famous interview, infamous interview. He came up with this 5 times the energy of the Earth, and this was quoted quite grandiosely by Stephen E. Jones at this. Truth and Accountability conference.
No, I don't think this would be the case again. I mean, obviously, from the numbers we've worked, that Kirk King works in the paper you sent me, which are quite reasonable, even though I haven't checked them thoroughly. But even if we were to exceed the power usage rate of the Earth, that's not implausible. It just happened that during that brief burst of time, there was this peak power output that exceeded the energy output of the Earth, but, so long as you have an explosive device capable of releasing it, you might be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so...
You know, I think what we can probably... I don't know my take on this, I don't know if you'd like to comment, is that once the bomb of that sort of magnitude goes off, I mean, be it 5 kilotons or a megaton or whatever, it's essentially an uncontrolled release. I mean, you know how much the total amount, you know,
is going to
come out.
Yeah, but you know very well how it's going to be spread out, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, because if you dropped it in the middle of New York, you wouldn't know which buildings were going to be completely obliterated and which weren't.
Right.
And we saw no nuclear effects, as we discussed
no,
in the first tower.
There was no radiation around the tower.
Well,
no.
not. I'm thinking primarily of the heat flash and...
No, there was no heat flash.
Firestorm.
There was nothing of the sort, no.
No, and there was no firestorm. You know, I mean, that's one of the scary things that was put on television in the 80s, I remember, about a nuclear explosion having an accompanying firestorm, which would, you know, come out from ground zero and engulf, you know, however you know, 20 square miles radius or whatever it was, you know, I can't remember the figure, but, and we saw none of this, none of these effects, and so we've had people saying, oh, well, it was micronuclear explosives, and I don't know of any micronuclear explosives. I heard of tactical nukes, but I don't know. You know,
I don't think so.
Them.
Again, if we go into micronukes, the way I was raised, I was led to believe that for explosions, not for control nuclear power plant release, but for nuclear explosions, you do need a minimum critical mass.
That's what I was
which is of the order of, 30 pounds, something like that.
Right.
For uranium. Below that, you're not going to get the detonation. So it's hard for me to conceive of a micronuke because by definition it would seem impossible. Perhaps there's been a theoretical and experimental breakthrough that has found out loopholes in this argument and allowed some conditions in which a smaller device might actually go off nuclearly, but I haven't heard of this. It would perhaps be the equivalent in explosives to cold fusion, to what cold fusion is to hot fusion, so to speak. But I haven't heard of such an equivalent thus far. And if that were the case, again, where is the radiation? You know, I want to throw in the questions that the skeptics of cold fusion, the uppercase skeptics of cold fusion threw at us before. You know, where is the radiation? Where are the gamma rays? Where is the helium? Well. Mm.
And I think we managed to sort of win the argument really when we found the Hutchison effect characteristics.
Yeah, because that is it truly more embracing a coherent explanation, isn't it?
You know, I mean, we'll probably come on to talk a little bit more about this with you, but you know, just all the characteristics seem to be a near perfect match. So you know,
very good match. You know,
yeah. Okay, so you mentioned briefly there about the electron spin.
Yes, I found out because obviously there are some who think that this extraction of free energy might have more to do with electron spin than with zero-point field. It might be that electron spin is just, my take is that it's just one of the golden keys that are granted to the initiate to open the magic door of the temple of free energy. So to
speak. Wow, yeah.
So in other words, it would be unlocking this helicoidal vibration of the quantum flux of the zero-point field energy that underlies all matter. And this would make sense. I found some theoretical advancements that point in this direction. For example, this paper that was published in 1993. Well, yeah, a corrective version. No, it was published in 1998, submitted in Quantum Physics, so it's a standard peer-reviewed publication. About Seter-Biwigung, an electron structure. Seter-Biwigung, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly because it's German, but, you know, it's just this stochastic motion of vibrational motion of electrons and particles that is attributed to the random fluctuations of the zero-point field and how Puthoff has very well connected this to the ground state of the hydrogen atom and explained that the stability of this ground state of hydrogen atom, and therefore perhaps of all matter, mm-hmm. is due to this Zeta-Dewey one, this vibration connected to the zero-point field. And this Zeta-Dewey one connects with the electron spin and via the Clifford algebra equation and the Dirac equation and blah, 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 which are over my head. But I can follow the gist of the argument. And there is also this theorist at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor more recently has published this study on the singularity-free electrodynamics for point charges and a model of electron self-energy and a spin. The problem of electron self-energies has plagued physics since the last century and hasn't really been solved yet. It's just been swept under the carpet in various guises. And again, perhaps the zero-point field energy might be the explanation, which, you know, might connect it all. So perhaps this spin is just the harmonic key to what's going on inside the electron. And in this website of Pure Energy Systems News, open to all these unconventional free energy devices, this Ken Kozeka, PhD, he says, announces that a former college dean has put forth a model to describe how the energy in magnet motors is generated from the electron spin that maintains the magnetism and that is essentially an atomic force at work, not energy from nowhere. So, you know, people are trying to explain these magnet motors alternatively by electron spin instead of zero-point field energy. And this is what George Beaux, that Frank Ferguson referred us to, has worked on. And somehow this knowledge escaped from Lockheed Martin's privacy agreements and is out in technical form out there in a book and so forth. Oh. And Paula Violet, of course, has often told Frank Ferguson, hey, Frank, this is all about a spin, you know, and it's not like we want to sound like Dan Rather on Fox News or something like that.
Yeah, we do live in a world of spin.
Right, but a spin has a lot to do with it, how we spin it. So I don't know what else to say, but I think it's obvious that the two are might just be two faces of the same coin. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay. So we've got the rest of this list of questions. That's very interesting about the electron spin. It's not something I know a lot about. And Frank keeps, you know, mentioning the new book by Paul Violet, which is the was it Secrets of Anti-Gravity?
Gravity Propulsion. Yes, I've read an excerpt from it, and it does sound coherent. And the key to these effects, to anti-gravity or electrogravitic, seems to be very, very high K dielectrics, very high dielectric constant dielectrics.
Right.
And the main one is, of course, barium titanate. And
yes.
It's been used, and there is literature about that and research going on about that, so it's no coincidence. But yeah, Paula Violet, I think he's figured out the model of how this quantum energy flux works, certainly. Yeah.
And I know that John Hutchison, I don't know if you read this, but he has also done experiments with barium titanate crystals himself.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
He has. We found that out. You know, he has that, confirmed that to us. And we also found barium titanate has been linked with chemtrails as well.
Uh-huh. Now, it's interesting, but I found in my CRC, which is the Thick Humongous Reference Book, that there is yet a substance with an even higher dielectric constant than barium titanate.
Oh.
Though barium titanate is really close second, and this other substance is some yttrium, niobium, something. I could look it up, but it's not something cheap that you can buy at the grocery store, certainly.
Right, yeah.
It's some rare earth thing, but yeah, it's got this dielectric constant of an order of thousands, and barium titanate is of like 2,000. Of course, it depends on direction in which you measure it, but
right.
a little bit. But yeah, they're huge constants.
Yeah, and if we can give an idea of what this dielectric constant means, because my understanding is that the dielectric is, if you go into an electrical component which stores charge, which is called a capacitor or a condenser by some, the dielectric is what you put in between the two plates.
Yes. If you put nothing, then you've got the vacuum, and
yeah.
that's the dielectric constant 1.
Right.
So anything that you put in there is just going to sort of increase the, not the resistance, that's another concept, but it's going to, oh gee, can you believe, you know, I got an A in this in my Caltech course, mm-hmm. and now it's I have to really scratch my head to remember the basics.
Right.
Of course, the electric field is found by dividing, for example, in a capacitor. This is the simple formula I remember. The uniform electric field that's going from one plate to the other is just the surface charge that you're putting on either plate, plus mm-hmm. or minus, divided by the dielectric constant,
right.
and divided by the permittivity of vacuum. Now, the product of the dielectric constant and the permittivity of vacuum is the dielectric is the permittivity of the medium. So, in other words, the dielectric constant just measures the relative permittivity of the medium compared to the vacuum. In other words, how permissive this medium is compared to the vacuum.
Yeah.
So the higher the dielectric constant for a given unit, a given surface charge on the capacitor, the lower the field is going to be. You're
right.
going to get a lower and lower and lower field.
Yes.
That much I think I got clear. For other yeah. things, I'll have to look them up and refresh
that's
up
okay.
a little bit.
that's okay. But yeah, people can look in the physics textbooks.
Right, right.
You
can
know.
Just look it up and work through things. Yes.
Mm,
of course,
mm.
The kinds of experiments that people who have worked on this pay attention to are no longer static electrostatic experiments, but are electrodynamic. You're looking at how waves propagate through, and for that you need not just the permittivity, but also the magnetic permeability, and
mm.
that way you can see the electromagnetic wave and so forth, and perhaps at a high enough density or field or something, some well-kept secret of the trade thing, the rupture of the space-time occurs in some way, and you get a gravity canceling effect, such as
mm.
the Plotnikov experiment or others that have confirmed this reduction in weight that Paul Avila refers to and others,
mm.
all the way to the John Searle disk just flying off the table.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, as I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I remember this correctly, but the permeability and the permittivity constants, if you multiply them together, do a square root and then do the reciprocal, that's the speed of light, isn't it?
Oh, yes. You know, they certainly
that.
Drilled that well into you, yeah.
I remember
Very
that.
Excellent, yes, A plus. Right.
So that's
right.
that's a relationship
so
between the speed of
if
light,
that
isn't
permittivity
it?
And permeability are those of vacuum, you get the speed of light.
Yeah.
If they are modified by the dielectric or diamagnetic constants, then you're going to get a lesser speed, which is why in a medium light propagates at a lesser speed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what you're going to get.
Okay.
You know?
Well, if we move on to the next question, which is sort of going into some technicalities, but
okay.
this was one of the ones that Frank asked, and I sort of added to a little bit. Now, we've seen these various effects at the World Trade Center, and Dr. Wood's area of expertise is interferometry,
okay.
which she's explained quite lucidly how she saw one of the cars,
mm-hmm.
which had apparently had like fringes on it, what she thought were fringes of constructive and destructive interference, like you get in the the Young Slits experiments.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And so she
saw
this.
Some telltale sign that some wave phenomena is going through.
Yeah, and Frank was basically asking, tying two things together, if if the electron spin, there's a way of affecting this using interfering beams. Now, I think we can probably only guess at the answer to this, but I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
Well, okay, is Frank referring to why the directive energy beam that could have then, that we postulate might have caused the destruction of the towers, how it came to go through the atmosphere without being noticed, perhaps?
I think it's partly that he's referring to, and also what was the, was, you know, I think what he's asking is, I think he's read this The Violet's book and whatnot, and other than George Bew and others, and I think he's thinking that the beams must have liberated energy from the electron spin or something. I guess that's what.
Yeah, it's very possible. Whether the energy storage was in the electron spin itself or in the underlying vacuum field, and the electron spin was just the golden key to unlock it, this wobbling, you know, gyrating helix.
Right.
It doesn't really matter. There was a disturbance, and the energy was released, and it was released in a pulse, electromagnetic type pulse release that perhaps caused these interference patterns, and, you know, popped some cars up while the next was down, and the next up, the next down, so forth. Yeah, I see that this might be possible. I don't think that the planners of 9/11 expected to toss cars up and down. I think that it's just collateral to happen. Or maybe they knew that some cars would be tossed, but they wouldn't care because it would be minor evidence and, you know, easy to cover up or you know, distance from the event. But yeah, I don't see a problem with an interference pattern and electromagnetic type disturbance, you know, coursing through some kind of field effect, certainly.
Okay. Sort of following on from that, one of the things that some people have thought is that if it was a beam, they tend to think of a beam of either microwave or
laser.
Right. Yeah, and this is of course been the source of various sort of ridicule and, you know, related kind of comments.
Death ray woman.
Yeah, you know, and all this nonsense. But we, you know,
referring to Judy Wood, just to
well,
declare
yeah,
her as
yeah.
a death ray woman, or
yeah, you know, and basically, you know, but if there was a beam, then why you know could it only affected the towers? And
why wasn't it seen?
Yeah, why wasn't it seen, and why did it only affect the towers? And you know,
if you have a microwave beam, that's not going to be seen. I mean, police
that's
routinely
right.
now use in our police state, you know, these microwave dishes for crowd control,
yeah,
and non-lethal weapons that John Alexander is such an expert at, and
yeah.
he's so fond of promoting. They basically beam microwaves to calm down the populace, subdue the mood, and of course they have these bad collateral effects on the brain and so forth, but let's not go into that. You know, you are beaming something that is not going to be seen. It's just going to cook up the air molecules in, you know, on the path. It's going to heat up anything that's on the path, of course. That's why you can put in a chicken and a television tower and cook it there, perhaps.
Yeah.
Some people have done it, but
yeah.
you're not going to see it. So
yeah.
maybe it was directed energy of this form. Maybe it was just a more laser-type beam, you know, fire from orbit, which is what Frank Ferguson has thought sometime, in which case you wouldn't have the logistic problem of hiding the weapon somewhere. And then, of course, is how come, you know, it wasn't noticed, was, you know, wasn't seeing that the air wasn't burned or something, or some ionized cloud or something. And here we go into the phase conjugation business.
Yes.
And this, Frank Ferguson told me, was already demonstrated by Nikola Tesla in the Wardenclyffe Tower experiment in 1901. That's
yeah.
over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
This fog, of course, wanted to beam large amounts of energy through the atmosphere, you know, which would spell panic and terror to the interests that wanted to control and meter the energy usage on Earth, say J.P. Morgan and so forth. So Nikola Tesla apparently did it already in an unconventional type beam. Perhaps it was a scalar type weapon of some sort. Nowadays, I think that the covert military-industrial complex well does have the capability of doing this with phase conjugation, and with that, in that manner, you're going to be able to send large amounts of energy in a focused, collimated way as a laser beam or a similar directed energy beam without causing much disturbance along the way until you reach the desired target. And this is terrifying that they can play with a joystick with that and, you know, set up the coordinates for destruction and mayhem. But that might be what might happen. And even in conventional academia, Frank and I found the other day through the web that some researchers are working on aspects of this that are finding their way into conventional physics. And this, we're talking about foil wave mixing and the Brillouin zone and the plasmoid waves and other research that has gone on, for example, in the physics department at UCLA or the University of Michigan. We try to approach at least one graduate student who was working there to see if he had any comments. Did they make any comments? But it's not out of the realms of possibility that something a bit more sophisticated than that was employed there already on 9/11. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think that, well, if you look at what John Hutchison's done. He doesn't talk about phase conjugation as such. Maybe what he's doing does end up being, you know, a form of phase conjugation. But all that he does is he mixes together different types of RF field, you know, RF fields and RF beams. He doesn't see any real heating of as such. I don't know if you've sort of looked into that much.
As a matter of fact, this past Saturday, I was just boning up on some of these class notes that I got from my studies at Caltech, and there was in the chapter on classical physics, it went into great detail, well, some introductory detail about three-wave mixing and four-wave mixing and the interference that results in it. It's very sophisticated, very complicated mathematically. You can only work up approximations of this, but this is a very interesting, very active area of research with the interference problem, because you're going to get nonlinear optics here. You're going to get orders, and the second order or third order contributions might cancel out. So the trick might be in this four-wave mixing, which is the phase conjugation that allows the beam to traverse the atmosphere without burning or ionizing molecules along the way, perhaps. This is just wild guess. I mean, I haven't done any hands-on experiments. I've just read what's out there a little bit.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff which is, you know, we can only guess at. And, you know, John doesn't really have, he doesn't write down a set of equations before he starts his experiment, you know.
Right. And I think that's what allows him to approach things with such a fresh state of mind without prejudice. And open to what the experiments might actually tell you. In theory, should follow after. You know, theory should come after.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right. The next thing, which is kind of in this similar sort of area, which I tried to explain myself on when we did the Ambrose Lane program, but I don't know if you can, you know, sort of elucidate about the Casimir force and how long it's been known about.
It's been on for a long while. This was we were explaining in the first part of this program yesterday. It's been known in conventional physics for a long time that there is this underlying sea of energy, the Dirac sea of particles and antiparticles and so forth, and the electromagnetic zero point field. But it was not thought that this could produce a detectable physical effect. In other words, that this was just an isotropic field that filled all of space, But because you can only get a force when there is a gradient in the field, in other words, a point that has a higher field a point that has a higher potential value than an adjacent mm-hmm. point, and all points were at the same value, it was just like this common zero that you can zero out of thing, and for practical purposes, you know, you just reset your potential scale to zero, and it's as if it wasn't there, because it will never be measured physically.
Right.
However, you know, some actually thought about this and say, wait a minute, maybe that's not entirely true, and there was this Dutch physicist, Casimir, I think, working, I think he was in Philips, perhaps, in the Netherlands, or somewhere like that, around
right.
1949. Mm-hmm. He figured out that, you know, if you have two parallel plate capacitors really close to each other, like, you know, Armstrongs close to each other,
yeah,
then you're going to get an effect whereby you're going to have all the modes of the electromagnetic field outside the plates, but inside you're going to get some cancellation of some of the modes. And as a result, you're going to get a very tiny, but in principle real, net force that's going to compress the plates. Now, he predicted this would happen, but at that point, the experimental technology wasn't on par with being able to measure and detect this. 4 decades or more would have to elapse, and recently, in the 1990s, this experimenter at the University of Washington, I forgot his name, and others in Sweden and other places, they found out, they at last were able to do the precise measurements, which I think they did with golden plates and a microscopic torque of, you know, a lever of some sort, nanotech almost, and or microscopic, and they were able to detect the force. And so this Casimir force was confirmed, and this was great vindication for the theorist of the zero-point field.
Right.
And, yeah, so that's just one great piece of evidence that the zero-point field is real and is exerting an effect there.
And I don't know whether this is, you know, I mean, you mentioned there that it's to do with two plates of a capacitor being, you know, very, very close together.
Very close, yes. Atomic distances.
Right, right. So we're talking about plates, and I mean, this Casimir force wouldn't necessarily come into play, you know, could it come into play in a crystal lattice at all, or, you know?
Yes,
or,
but it would be a different form. I mean,
right.
the Casimir force really is just this catch-all word for the parallel plate type capacitor thing. You're obviously going to get a real effects from the zero point field in other circumstances, even microscopic, but they will be called differently. The Lamb shift, the spontaneous decay of an electron in an atom at this hyperfine frequency that is 1,040 megahertz, if I recall correctly, this was another confirmation of the zero point field energy. And there have been others. Now, the divide between conventional academia and the unorthodox free researchers, so to speak, is that, you know, conventional academia will say, okay, these real effects are sort of these minor Casimir-type effects. It's still way far from being something serious with real muscle, you know. Whereas the free energy researchers say, wait, no, you know, we have these working magnetic motors that are producing these watts that you can begin to scale up towards using homes and so forth.
Right.
So that's the divide. And as far and the Hutchinson effect, of course, is this huge, very spectacular form of anomalous energy and work and force and objects shooting up into the air. And the natural explanation is some form of electrogravitics or antigravity, which is the other side of the coin of free energy. So, you know, if you want to talk about Casimir force on a big scale, that would be it, or a real
right.
macroscopic demonstration of the reality and physical impact of zero-point field energy, that would be it. And it's not, you know, and if the effect on the metals, the bending of the metals, the the wrapping up of the cans and the jellies and so forth, and the embedding of knives inside aluminum, and the spontaneous burning of metal and things like that that are seen in some of these Hutchinson experiments, if they correlate so well with some of the bizarre collateral phenomena observed around the towers on 9/11, as Judy Wood has pointed out, then, you know, you have this great match, and you've got this microscopic deployment of free energy correlated with the Hutchinson effect being on a larger scale what was deployed on 9/11, right?
Yeah, sure. And I think that brings me on to the next sort of point in that, you know, you're obviously, you've got a lot of background in the sciences and the physics, as you've already discussed, but you know, I know I'm pretty sure, unless I've got the hopes wrong, that you're not a tenured professor or anything.
No, way, nothing like
you're,
that.
You're not in charge of any research projects.
Absolutely
at the moment.
Absolutely not. No, I don't even work on anything related. You know, I don't get any livelihood. I don't know how to.
Sure.
Yeah, out of anything related to my physics degree, which was just a master's degree. I never finished my doctorate. I just started it.
Right.
I worked as a research assistant for a while. Now I work on things totally unrelated to that.
Okay.
But this remains, of course, my strong amateur interest, and I keep following it intimately, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, myself sort of similar in, you know, in many ways, in that I assess students for a living now, and that's nothing to do with advanced science or anything, but you know, to a lesser extent than yourself, I've maintained an interest and a knowledge in some of the theory and some of the developments that have gone on over the years, you know, and the
right.
This Large Hadron Collider and all that, you know, I've followed that a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, what my question really is, I mean, we're basically just, you know, slightly more knowledgeable than your average person, but so...
In some area,
yeah. Yeah, so there must be other people who know what happened.
That's
what I'm leading up
you
to.
You bet there are.
So, you know, I just want
you
to talk about
that. You bet a lot of
that.
Them are working in universities, but, you know, some of them, I think, are going to be malicious. They're going to be in collusion with what happened, to an extent, of course. They may have been persuaded to think that the sacrifice, Pearl Harbor-type sacrifice, was necessary to advance an ill-defined new American century type agenda. Others will certainly disagree with this and even find this revolting that this may have been kept under wraps and used in such a gray and evil fashion on 9/11, but they will not dare speak up, of course, for the fear of losing their positions and their livelihood and their, you know, sustenance of their families and so forth. So one, of course, has to, I mean, you cannot be the hand that feeds you, really, and there are many constraints for those who want to eke out a living in academia, especially in this time of shrinking funds and so forth.
That's
so,
true, yes, yeah.
Yeah, well, funds are shrinking unless you go and work on the military, you know, defense,
yes.
Of course, you know.
Yes,
for,
yeah.
For them, you know. There's never a shrinkage of funds, I would think.
No, that's what it seems like, and this is what Eisenhower essentially warned about, didn't he, in 61, you know, that was his essential warning that, you know, a government contract was a substitute for intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, and very sadly, science has become, you know, over the Cold War, it became bureaucratized. It became this huge inertia machine that just... assures you a certain kind of living and comfort, provided that you stay away from unconventional, sensitive, touchy topics that are really those that could make a real difference and be really interesting. And so long as you work on something very tediously boring that the layperson is not going to be able to crack through to the significance because of the jargon, then you're going to be isolated in some ivory tower kind of research lab, and you will not be rich, and you will have, you know, many scarcities, but you will be able to have a relatively secure living. And many scientists, very understandably and very humanely, have opted for this. I'm not anyone to blame them, but I just have to point out that, you know, this is what happens, and it all comes down to the structure of fear in which we live, and, you know, it's not easy to begin to challenge it sometimes.
Absolutely, and, you know, my view is that, you know, what we're presenting here about the destruction of the World Trade Center is correct. I think once you've looked at the evidence, it becomes clear that it wasn't any type of conventional technology.
No.
We're looking at something, what has been developed in secret programs. I've been saying this for, for I think almost 2 years now, you know, since I first came across the original study, before Judy had tied it up with the Hutchinson effect, before Dr. Wood had tied it up with the Hutchinson effect. You know, I knew that it was something. When she'd shown all those pictures, I knew that it was something which didn't fit into the bombs in the building alone category.
Right. So you had gone into tier one of 9/11 discovery. In other words, it was an inside job, but you hadn't yet made it to tier two.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Right. I was still in with the bombs in the building.
Conventional bomb. Controlled demolition. You know. Oklahoma City bomb type thing.
Yeah. But also, I mean, that's another point, actually, is the Oklahoma City bomb does, as you may have, I don't know if you've looked, it does share some of the characteristics.
It certainly does, and it certainly opened the way for the onslaught on civil liberties and constitutional rights in America, yes.
But even looking at the physical characteristics, there's got circular cutouts in the top of the building and...
No, I think that the OK City bomb, it was a form of controlled demolition, but just a form of advanced controlled demolition, the way General Martin has pointed out.
Right.
Something like that.
I don't know, because I haven't studied it that much, but what did intrigue me was the picture that Dr. Wood posted of the inside of World Trade Center 6 side by side with the OKC building, the Alfred P. Murrah building.
Right.
That's on the website. If you haven't seen that picture, it is worth looking at, because it's very, very interesting.
I think I've seen it. Another researcher who has also compared it to and is quite brave, and I think he's also willing to go where the evidence takes you, is Victor Thorne of American Free Press, and he has published this 9/11 Evil and other books, and I've listened to him. I like him.
Right.
Of course, he will not touch the directive energy thing. He will not endorse it, but he will be open to it. He also probably has to take care of his own living, and, you know, as a journalist of the alternative variety for American Free Press. So, there are boundaries and boundaries and boundaries, and the farther out you go from the mainstream, the tougher living becomes for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
The more interesting things become, because you get to see the truth, but there's a price for that.
Yes, I think that can be true for many people. But I think, you know, now we're really faced with this situation of realizing that the free energy technology is not only is it real, which a lot of people still dispute.
They still dispute, yes.
Yeah, but we know that it's real because of the work of yourself and many others like you.
Oh, I haven't done any work. Please don't misattribute.
Well, I was really thinking back to the work that you did at MIT.
But that was just a very minor student contribution. Just one more hay to the haystack, you know.
Well, exactly, but I mean, at least you have you were observing things like consultation, you know, and this is very important. Because it is a process which I assume is, you know, there isn't a definite explanation for it yet, as I think you were describing yesterday. There are probably several different mechanisms which have been proposed. I've just posted an article recently that we are now faced with a choice of letting the people, the establishment as it stands and as it functions now, if they're going to cover up this technology and not investigate what's been put on the table, then the establishment really serves no purpose at all.
People are now afraid, you know, my parents are afraid, you know, what if this mortgage meltdown continues? What if the whole financial system goes to hell? I say, you know, the sooner the better.
Yes, yeah, I'm tempted
Now, of
to
course,
think that
the
way.
reaction is scary. How are we then going to live? How are we going to eat? Now, yes, there will be some basic living necessities that we will have to address, but at the same time, the entire creative human spirit will be unleashed, and we will not anymore have to conform to these structures that oppress us, though some are more willing to admit it than others, of course.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, but if the establishment's function, if I may just take a slight step back, if the establishment's function is to, in science, to develop new technologies and to, you know, develop them for the benefit of all and to improve our standard of living.
In theory, that should be the motto, yes. Same as the police, to protect and serve. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So, you know, there seems to be a common theme here in that nearly all of the established institutions now are really not serving the purpose for which they were, you know, actually started.
For very human reasons, but yes, that's the case.
You know, and if this technology isn't investigated and isn't used to produce cheap energy or free energy for the world,
right?
Then what is the point of having scientific research? You might as well just shut the whole bang lot down because...
Yep.
You know, it's not serving a purpose.
And it's not serving a purpose.
If we've got a secret group somewhere, whoever that group is, taking cherry picking the research of people like John Hutchison, John Bedini, and
right.
Tesla, Thomas
Paul
Townsend Allen, Brown.
You know,
I'm sure you can name it.
Correa and all of them, yeah.
And they're just weaponizing it. You know, then
right. They're just perverting it. You know, to use it as directive energy forms of some kind, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're all slaves to that, really, aren't we? I mean, that's...
Yes,
that's the end result.
The rising up from the shackles is not easy. I mean...
No,
it's not. It's just one step at a time. And there is that point of maximum impact and common sense. You know, if you're too cowardly, you're going to regret your actions. You know, like what they said, you know, I didn't say anything under the Nazis when they went after the Poles because
yeah.
I wasn't a Pole. I didn't do anything when they went after the Gypsies because I wasn't a Gypsy. Didn't do anything when they went after the Jews because I wasn't a Jew. Mm-hmm. Now, when they finally went after me, there was no one to help me because I haven't helped all the other people before they were gone.
That's right. That's
right. So
that
happens
right.
When you're too cowardly. Now, if you happen to be, as it was my mistake, sort of, in my younger years, and to an extent, it's a problem of youth, perhaps. If you're too brave, too bold, too much of a troublemaker, you're also not going to be effective because all you're going to get is that you're going to be nailed, you're going to be taken to prison, or you're just going to be sedated in a psychiatric ward of some sort, or discredited, or whatever. There is in between a point of maximum impact, where you can really break the mold and live the light and set an example to others without being a fool and taking unnecessary risks. And sometimes it's hard to gauge where that might be. Mm. So.
Yeah, I agree. Well, if we move on a little bit, because I wanted to just ask you about... this idea of a scalar weapon and how you interpret that, because
right.
That's bandied around a lot.
It's been bandied around, and it's another variation on the topic. Now, Tom Barden is, of course, one of the experts on everything is scalar. We have to understand that we haven't been told the real truth about electromagnetics, and the lie starts with the textbooks and the laws of Maxwellian electrodynamics that ignore the so-called scalar term, and as a result ignore this possibility to extract copious amounts of energy from the vacuum. They also ignore the possibility of beaming energy and information faster than light. And
right.
This has been done in the covered programs, and that's how real contact with extraterrestrial civilizations is done, not through the SETI mockery,
right?
As researcher Brian Desborough refers to.
I've not heard of him, right. That's interesting, yeah.
Well, I mentioned him. He's the one that I referred to without a name, and that's the C-level Rice paper that you like so much. This
right.
contractor in California, and David Icke found him, and they made a good team, and He's a good fellow. I've read his book, and it's great. And he's really doing some great work out there. So anyway, this scalar thing allows you to send these electromagnetic pulses, which are no longer conventional electromagnetic. You know, they're something else because they have this scalar time-independent component, and this can permit instantaneous communication and delivery. And as Tom Berdan has pointed out, it can also allow you to hit a point and certain coordinates without having to send any beam towards it.
Really?
Right. So you can just set ground zero as the target and hit it with a pulse or some diffraction, scalar type, and nothing will have to be beamed along the way to hit it the way you would have to using conventional, even electromagnetic pulses. And perhaps this is what was used. Perhaps it's not even necessary to resort to four-wave mixing and phase conjugation. You can arrange the diffraction to happen on ground zero remotely, just by setting the coordinates in space, you know, so that at this point in time they will be hit, and no energy beam will have had to traverse the atmosphere or any medium to get there.
Right, right. Yes, because it's something I've
heard Tom Berdan speak about this, and I was shocked out of my wits, and I don't get shocked easily after the kind of stuff that I have come across, but this really was shocking, and because I think he was talking about this a long time ago. So, where will the military-industrial complex be right now if Berdan was talking about this years ago?
Well, that's it, and I have this YouTube clip from this video he made. He was at
McDonald's. It's great watching. I started. Thanks for sending me the link. This lecture he gave in the 80s.
Mm.
Yeah, terrific. Great stuff.
Very, very interesting. And, you know, I must say that I think Tom Berdan must be one of the people who knows actually what they did.
Know, but he knows that if he talks about 9/11, he's gonna be found floating down the river. He knows it. That's my suspicion, anyway.
I think that's true.
Because he's obviously, you know, touched the real McCoy here and worked with, you know, he's not the underground type person, but he shakes hands with them. So, you know, he's doing great work for humanity, but, you know, he knows where the boundary is, that, you know, if he crosses it, he's going to be found floating down the river.
And I think just, you know, we're getting towards the end, but we've come on to one of the topics that lecture was about, which is weather modification.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was pretty stunned by the Hutchison effect stuff that Dr. Judy Wood posted. But then when she found the hurricane on 9/11, I thought, right, well, you know, this is it, folks.
quite an interesting match. How come it wasn't alluded to on 9/11 the way the Ballyhooed hurricane, Katrina and other hurricanes, right?
So I wondered what your thoughts were on the weather modification technology.
Well, it's certainly there, and Tom Berdan extensively talks about it, and with all the scalar mayhem out of control, as well as the power plant in HARP that is just harping the hell out of our poor ionosphere.
Seems like it.
Yeah, then you certainly can engineer a tempest in a teacup and a storm to hit India or any country that you want to punish. And this guy Benjamin Fulford, that Frank Ferguson referred us to, has certainly shut his mouth and said that this is indeed what was done to Japan as a punishment for refusing to play along in the world order, and then also David Rockefeller agenda. But yeah, I think it's real and it can be done, and quite possibly it was done on 9/11. I mean, Judy Wood has unearthed this connection that there was this hurricane structure hovering menacingly near Manhattan on that day, and also that there were these magnetometer anomalous readings all the way from Alaska to another place, and all pretty much coinciding with the point when the towers were hit, which, again, reminds me of the Oklahoma City bomb and the famous glitch, the famous two-spike glitch that was observed in the seismometer data that obviously pointed to the fact that more than one bomb went off.
Oh, okay.
You know, and of course that seismological record has then been disputed, and you've had your hack man, your hack job man, and academia paid to discredit the idea by saying that you can get the same effect by some form of SP wave earthquake type thing, but I don't buy it. I mean, I think it was observed. And similarly, on a bigger scale, this is what may have happened on 9/11, and so it all seems to add up together. The Hutchinson effect, the band metals, the toasted cars, the dustification, the coal, the surrounding anomalous magnetometer data, the hurricane hovering around. This all is smacks of a form of electromagnetic scalar type disturbance that was set on to trigger the mayhem. And there was all this collateral that they really didn't care much about, and some of which actually goes on today, as Frank Ferguson has reported. The destruction of the towers set off a non-self-quenching destruction of the steel that it still goes on, and they have to gather in truckloads and you know, trucks to continue holding away the truckloads of all the dust that continues to accumulate because the process hasn't stopped. I've heard this. I haven't seen it confirmed.
I visited New York in January, and they were shipping in, or shipping out rather, quantities of earth in these trucks.
Uh-huh.
And we saw them hosing down this cable. I've mentioned this several times.
Okay.
There was like a cable or some type of pipe, and they were really giving it a good wash down. It wasn't just like a little squirt. This guy spent probably several tens of seconds washing this cable or pipe hanging down. You know, he's washing it down. And they're still taking down the Bankers Trust building, which they obviously repaired initially.
So it did look like they were concerned that this pipe might be contaminated with something?
Yeah, that's what it looked like to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can't think of a construction.
What would it be? They certainly know a bit more about it. You bet it was an asbestos.
Well, exactly. You know, we were, you know, 6 years on at that time, nearly 7 years on, well, over 7 years on now.
Oh, yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, so, and there's no, I don't think, in the actual World Trade Center site, I believe there isn't really any new construction. I'd heard reports they started in one corner of the site.
They want to build up this feral type huge new monument, and the project has been awarded, I think, to a Spanish architect, Santiago Calatrava, who's this famous architect. I think he's based in Switzerland now. My cousin actually worked for him, I think, for a while, or thought of working with him, or had a chance, or something like that. So I said, well, if this justification of the Ground Zero goes on, you know, let him have it. Let him have the glory, because it's not something I want to get my hands dirty with.
No.
You know, until they figure out how to stop it and, of course, disclose it. But for that, they would have to probably admit that something bizarre and unaccounted for happened. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've also seen one of the things that interests me is we've had reports of a couple of crane collapses in New York, which we've followed in the last sort of few years. And this, to me, you know, flick my switch because of a chap called Wilbert Smith. I don't know if you've heard of Wilbert Smith and his work on binding forces. And
I haven't heard of him, but go ahead.
Yeah, and he said he was given information by the boy's topside, and he built what's called a binding meter. I've got a little lecture where he talks about this, and he said that he could measure the binding forces in a given location with this little simple instrument that he was told how to make. He said that in Toronto the binding forces were you know, weaker than other places they visited. This meter he had showed a lower reading.
Why in Toronto?
I don't know, but he said that there were a few structural failures in Toronto around that time, you know, just more than would be normal. It wasn't anything that was on a huge scale. And he was sort of pointing out that it seemed to be that these binding forces in certain places could account for the sudden disintegration of aircraft. You know, there'd been some mysterious air crashes with no explanation, and it's as if these aircraft just like fell apart in midair. And that's what he was. This was in the 50s, I have a feeling that what he was picking up was something to do with, some way that this ongoing effect of the Hudson effect, you know, is affecting.
Might be.
Yeah,
sounds
sort
of scary. It's almost like a Stephen King movie.
Yeah, yeah, and Wilbur Smith had said that he had told by the people from outside that when the nukes were set off, it would affect regions of binding around the area of the explosion and on the opposite side of the Earth.
Oh wow!
So
is this scientist still alive?
No, he died in 62, but
I've
got the information from Grant Cameron.
Maybe I've heard of him. Now, yeah. Of course. Oh, there is also the harmonics of the Earth, which is with Bruce Cathy, the New Zealander, who studied in connection with UFOs. You know, where it's like certain points on the grid of the Earth are more vulnerable to stuff happening than others. And some speculate that the nuclear explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were, you know, set, you know, on these trigger points or something.
This
esoteric science we haven't been told a whack about.
Yeah. Yeah,
to understand what's going on, you know, oh boy, this is this matrix of information, like in the movie The Matrix, you know, that, you know, we don't know what's really out there in front of our eyes, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just one other minor thing with the hurricane, and I think what Doctor would have picked up on was that the hurricane has a similar sort of profile and topology to a Tesla coil.
I saw the pictures, and they, you know, the similarity is quite striking, really. Very striking. I mean, you have this like this huge wig, you know, of hair wig, but you know, hanging out, and it's like a coil, a toroidal shape, really, and it's got, you see the picture side by side of the hurricane and the Tesla coil experiment or the Hutchinson effect, and, you know, something is telling you something. You're being told something there. So I think we have pretty much cordoned off the area of what may have happened here. Now, of course, to determine who's who on the crime side, you know, that is an effort that is going to involve many more like-minded people like us out there. So if anyone are out there listening, I encourage you to share what you know and take part and face your fears, okay? It's important to realize that the fear is there. Don't try to minimize it or, you know, to ignore it. It's there. There are risks associated with opening your mouth and going public and revealing what you know and taking a stand. But at the same time, there is also the call of your heart that you know you have to do something about what's right. So I will leave to our listeners to find out how to share and activate this information.
Yes, I agree. And, I sort of just reemphasize that what's at stake really here is we're told about all this nonsense about climate change. We've got clear evidence of weather control on 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
And then obviously the energy question, which is the other global issue facing mankind, that, you know, depleted fossil fuels and all that nonsense. But this whole deal with the World Trade Center is really central to those two issues, if not, you know, most of the others that face us. You know, we haven't even got into things like the cancer con and all this stuff, you know. So it really is a time, I think, for people deciding what they're going to try and do, you know, whether they're going to just
live
go
in
the
a
system.
Police state where, you know, you're not even going to be able to shit your toothpaste through the airport. Or we're going to live in a place where you can breathe some fresh air, you know.
Yeah, you know, I think that is ultimately.
People are going to have to make a choice here.
I agree.
Absolutely.
I agree.
Yeah, and it was an absolute pleasure to share these two evenings with you, and I hope that we may have fired some spark of action or initiative in some of our listeners, so this thing can hopefully snowball, and Judy Wood can get some help. I understand she's trying now to get this to court.
Yes.
And I wish her good luck, but, you know, for that, you know, you would have to topple the entire justice system, which is only created to protecting justice. So wish her the best, and hopefully one day, you know, the headlines will open on the news channels and saying, well, it's now being revealed that 9/11 was an inside job and it was caused by this horrendous form of free energy perversion that could solve all of our energy needs right now.
Yes.
So I won't hold my breath, but for this to happen, but I don't give up my hope to see it one day.
No, well, you know, it may not happen in that the form that we think, but, yeah, I mean, me too. I hope that, obviously, that will be the end result, is everyone does know about it, and,
right.
You know, we are able to change our future.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful pleasure to be with you, and may the force be with you, Andrew.
And you, Conrado. Thank
you.
All right, so thanks for giving us your time. Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Yeah.